There will also be perhaps some movement in about an hour when some students have to go to another class. I would ask if you have a 10 o'clock commitment to another class, if you can't stay, I would encourage you to stay, but if you can't, please leave quietly so that you don't disturb the others who are paying attention. After a very successful career as a journalist for the Boston Herald, where he won a Pulitzer Prize, and for Time Magazine, where he was a contributing editor, then as a freelance writer and ghostwriter, Donald Murray turned his attention to teaching in the early 60s and built the writing program at the University of New Hampshire. It was there as a student, and a few years later as a new teacher of writing myself, that I first met Don Murray, the writer and teacher. I want to share a few observations about him as a teacher because I think they support his continuing work on the writing process. Simply put, my observations are these. First, he practices what he preaches. Second, he is generous with his time, his ideas, his praise, and his criticism. Third, he is genuinely interested in his students. And fourth, he consistently demonstrates concern for the disadvantaged, who are often, in our schools, the student writers themselves. As an undergraduate, I saw Don Murray's work ethic up close. At a time when it was common for professors to offer 30 or 40 minutes of inconveniently scheduled office time to their students, Don Murray routinely held 10 or 15 or 20 hours or more of scheduled conferences week after week, semester after semester. Without fail, he took his students seriously. He actually requested and then listened to their concerns. And he shared his own struggles as a writer. For an undergraduate writer, his approach was most refreshing and, if I may use an overused term, revolutionary. I was fortunate to begin teaching with Don Murray as my mentor. In addition to providing support groups and performing crisis intervention, Don Murray provided methodology. How often, I wonder, did he find me wandering in the halls of the English building with a dazed look on my face? He would give me a word of encouragement and then hand me an article or two or three that he was distributing. To this day, I keep and periodically consult dozens of these articles, written by a variety of people and also by himself. Even before I read any of his books on writing, I had read the early drafts in the form of these articles. What better education than to see the ideas forming, developing, becoming the useful instruments they are in their present form for teachers and student writers alike. I was watching the process approach take shape, although to me, for many years, it was simply the Murray method. While Don Murray is probably known to you primarily for his pioneering and theoretical work in the writing process, I have always regarded him as a practical man. His ideas come, it seems to me, not so much from hypothesis and arcane strategies as from experience, from the tired feet of a reporter, from the careful eye of an editor, from the strong voice of a novelist, even, if you will, from the heart of a poet. His authority comes from experience and from a clear point of view. He was and is a writer who teaches writing. Would you welcome with me Donald Murray?
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here and touched by such a welcoming of an old friend who discreetly doesn't mention all the other things. It's interesting to have your habits exposed of spreading out and giving handouts to people all the time. And I realize I gave Jim a handout last night and started at breakfast this morning by handing him a handout. So what a compulsion I have to do. I was the handout king of our English department, and the budget became balanced when I left copying things. What I want to do is to interact with you as much as possible to make this as much a time when we work together and learn together as we can, given the large auditorium and the formality of the pulpit and all of this. And I hope that, and I know that there will be a lot of time for questions and for discussion. I want you to write with me, and I'll give you times to write as we go through this, so that you may be able to discover in some ways some of the things that I'm talking about. What I want to talk about is pushing the edge. We point our students towards the safe center of tradition, yet the best writing by inexperienced and experienced writers is written at the edge. By the edge, I don't just mean experimental writing that skates out on thin black ice and beyond, although that is a significant form of edge. And I do not mean peacock writing in which the author calls attention to the author rather than the subject. I'm talking about writing that creates meaning so powerful it becomes part of the reader's experience. When you're my age, you realize that so much of your experience is what you have read, what you have dreamt, what you have seen, what you have made up, and what you've actually experienced. That your reality becomes a sort of personal myth, all made up of the various legends that have crossed and become part of your life. And to write such things that can be transposed by readers into part of their own life, you have to get to the edge of experience. We write such words best when we have the essential illusion of invention, when we write what we have not yet written in ways that we have not written, when we push back the familiar horizon of subject, form, or voice. I say illusion because few of us truly create what has not existed before, and I think that's why often that most writers cringe at the word creative writing. Because it's as if we could write something that was new, something that wasn't written by the old Greeks, for example. We do not find new material, rarely design new forms, speak in new voices. But we must believe at the time of writing and revising that this text has not been written until we write it, that this story has not been told until we tell it, that this song has not been sung until we sing it. The edge is the outer limit of our confidence and experience when we attempt more than has been possible for us before. It's a very personal horizon and edge. We must train ourselves, and if we are teachers, train our students, to move out from the familiar field into the unfamiliar woods, from the known towards the unknown, from success towards failure. We must adventure when we write, exploring what we have not known in ways we fear that will not work. Writing is a daily delight for me, perhaps even an obsession or a compulsion, because I have learned to be satisfied with modest adventures. A quick peek around a corner can satisfy me as much as an ocean vista. I revel in the fragmentary insight, an interestingly awkward turn of phrase three quarters of a way through the essay, the rebellious semicolon, the secondary meaning glimpsed behind a familiar word. I'm a mild revolutionary, writing in the awareness of reader expectation, but weaving against those expectations, hoping to surprise my readers into recognizing what they have felt but not articulated in their lives. In this talk, I intend to reveal some of the neighborly edges which we push in our writing and demonstrate how these modest adventures make my morning so full that it takes discipline, guilt, and the force of willpower for me not to write. Let's explore the edge together, remembering the purpose is to reveal and clarify a meaning that we hope will surprise us. That's a question that I would ask in conference more than any other question of a student. What surprised you? What did you learn? What did you write that you didn't expect to write? That's the essential writing experience for me, and the place where I want any teachers that I work with, any students I work with, to get to, so that they write in such a way that they write what they don't expect to write. We have often been taught, I was taught, certainly, to know what you want to say before you say it. If that were true, I wouldn't be a writer. It's the mystery and the answering of a question I don't even know has been asked that's the excitement in writing. So we need certain conditions for this to happen. There are really three parts of these conditions for me. We need an experiment, a question that has not been asked before, has not been asked in this way. All writing is experimental. And out of the experiment comes an instructive failure. Science could teach us a lot from this. You have experiments. Experiment means they try to do something, and most times they don't achieve it. But by trying, they learn something more, and they can work in that direction. Writing is this way. If you're not failing in your writing, you're not learning. You've got to be able to write where you fail. The thing that I see in school more often than not is not bad writing, but safe writing, mediocre writing, McDonald's kind of writing, predictable writing. And what we have to do is to hear individual voices dealing with the world in a way that is their own. And to handle the questions of experiment and failure, I think it's important that you have a sense of humor. It allows us to delight in the difference between what should be and what is. You have this wonderful text in your mind, and then on the screen or on the pad of paper is the reality text. So you have to deal with the two. And this one is never as good as that one. We had a person in our department who would always vote against everybody for tenure, because no matter how many books they wrote, it could never be as good as the book he had not yet written. And the imaginary book stood there in the sky above him as a goal that nobody could achieve, including himself. So we need to remember the work of writing is a human condition, so it must be celebrated. It's too important to work, it must be play. So I try to play with writing. The first thing that I'm going to do, and I want then you to do, is to write a text from memory. I'll tell you when I want to do this. We hope not for an accurate reproduction of that text, but the recreated memory of a paragraph that is not written until now. Don't look back, look anew. We can be instructed by first graders. Remember when Don Graves, a researcher in writing, who had a lot of training in formal training when he came to the university, a lot of this he has now forgotten and has become a world authority because he'd gotten away from his training. He was upset that first graders, if he tried to get them to rewrite, would just turn the paper over and start a new story. And he said this is a matter of an early developmental stage. And that drove me crazy because I said, that's what I do. I just start anew. And it's important to just forget the text and do it again with the half memory of that text that you have. So I'm going to give you, in each case, I'll give you examples of things I wrote under the same conditions that you'll have here. In other words, in 2 and 3 and 4 minutes. A lot of my writing is done in small fragments of time. I have what I call a day book with me, and I have little cards in my pocket, and I use fragments of time in which to write little things. So this is what I've written. I'm alone in the memories of high school, trapped in the school, but alone in the corridor, outside the classroom, the silhouette of a skinny kid I can barely make out in the shadows of the long corridor. But when I make it to him and squeeze into that still growing form, I realize he is happy, happiest when he is not filled with the anxiety of companionship. Now that's just a small fragment of writing, but it's exciting to me because I was surprised by it. I chose to write about school because of many people here are in school, and I thought you might identify with it, but I was worried about it because of a column I'd published in the Globe, which is reprinted in the third edition of Right to Learn. I had thought high school an unhappy time, not as unhappy as elementary school for me, but pretty awful. I didn't like school. And in writing this one line, I have discovered a happiness I didn't expect. And the happiness was a surprise because it was when I was alone. And this predicted things. I'm now writing a novel about the war. And during combat, I would volunteer for dangerous duty, but I never thought of it as dangerous duty. And I realized now why I volunteered. It was simply I could go off and do it my own way. If you're a private in the Army, you have everybody, generals and colonels and majors and captains and lieutenants and sergeants, all telling you what to do. And I found it wonderful to go off and do it my way. I like to be alone. So it's interesting. And the anxiety of companionship, that for me is a line. Writing usually starts with me from a line. The kind of tension that you can see if you sit at a school, as I did this morning, waiting for people to come to breakfast and meet their friends, you observe the anxiety of companionship, the terrible anxiety that you will be accepted by the right people, rejected by the right people, that you will meet people like you, that you will express in one way or another that you're different from other people. There were a few people that came together who dressed, including their haircuts and everything, the same way. You could see them come together. It was wonderful. And they were expressing the anxiety of companionship that I felt. So this is what happens for me when I write, that I have some discovered thing. I don't think up the idea. I write and then discover the idea in the writing. So I want you to write a paragraph from memory of a previous draft, something you've written about before. On the other hand, if it doesn't occur, if just a piece of writing occurs, fine, if it's something new. But if you have something in mind, something you've written before recently that you remember or some time ago, just write it again now. I do 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes. Sometimes it feels like a lot longer. Getting the raw material of writing. I didn't expect to write myself with you, but then standing up here, I've been having an image the last few days that interests me. And I don't know where the whole thing started, but when I had a bypass several years ago, they took out my heart for 91 minutes and played with it in the operating room. You know, tossed it around, looked at it, did things to it. and doctors are very callous about this sort of thing while I lay in a machine. And I find myself interested in what that heart did. You could say that the heart lived 91 minutes longer than I did, or you could say that it died for 91 minutes and came back. And in poetry or fiction, in some way I may play with this, I found myself standing up here. A thought came in my head, so I put it down. My heart, I discovered, was a gossip. Take it from me while I was mated to a machine. It held the told the story of the high school love letters and how they, my handwriting is so bad, and how they were read at a party by the girl I had sent them to while I sat smiling, dying. I don't want to go on too much, but this has developed. One of the most awful moments of my childhood or youthhood was that I wrote these wonderful love letters to when I was a junior in high school. And at a party, the moment of greatest hilarity at the party was when she read them to the group. It was not a great moment for me. I was in the middle of the party, and I lay, you know, stood there smiling and laughing with them, but I wasn't laughing inside. And somehow, maybe that's something I've kind of hidden from myself, but maybe my heart would tell it, say, hey, this is the kind of guy, you know, I come from. Look what a silly idiot he was, and so on. So I have fun exploring these different things. The next thing that I would ask you to do is to look for the tension within the subject. The tension within the subject of my heart is once you start playing with this idea, which is very spooky, there's a lot of depression after bypass operations. And they don't know why. I didn't suffer any of that. But it is a very strange experience to have an organ that is so celebrated in literature and in theology as your heart. The place where your emotions perhaps rest, the place where love is, the place where belief may be, that is separated from you and then returns. And so there's a natural tension there. And what I write is usually involved with a central tension. A friend of mine is doing a story in Washington that relates to, actually two stories that relate to two central tensions. The U.S. government opposes our citizens smoking and is encouraging sending our cigarettes overseas. They're signing big, huge contracts with the Russian government. Now the Russians are our friends, so we send them cigarettes. There's a terrible irony and tension in that. The same thing is true that there are something in the order of 90 drugs that are so harmful to people that we will not give them to our own citizens, but we send them to Asia, to Africa, to Latin America. And so there's a tension, a kind of journalistic tension. 42 years ago, a black friend of mine, and I realized my first black friend in writing a piece about this that I wrote, had been a captain in the Army, was a college graduate, was a government scientist, and in coming home from work one night, he needed to go to the men's room. He went into a bar in a nice part of Boston. While he was in the men's room, he didn't drink, he just went to the men's room. This was desperate medical necessity. And two detectives, white detectives, jumped him, arrested him, held him incommunicado for 3 days. His wife couldn't find him, his friends couldn't find him. I was a police reporter, so at last I found where he was. I got a tip that a black man was being held off the books, went there, created a fuss for a number of hours, and they bought him out. They gave him his belt and his wallet. He was holding up his pants, and they said, if you sign this form that you won't charge us, we'll let you go. And I started to raise Cain and say, we're going to expose this, and he just signed it. He didn't talk to me. I drove him home to his wife, and he disappeared into the black community. And I was understood. I was horrified, but understood. He didn't, you know, I was the rescuer, but he was a better man than I am, was. And to have rescuing him was humiliation for him, and he couldn't handle it. I wrote a column in which I mentioned that. We had a racial incident in Boston, and I mentioned this story, not using his name or anything. And that night, the phone rang, and he called up. And we're, as soon as we get back from a trip to Greece in November, we're going to have dinner with them. And he and his wife talked on the phone with me for perhaps an hour, I guess it was. It was as if we hadn't had the 40 years. But it's that kind of tension you see, in that there was a tension in the piece. There was the tension of the black and white communities. There was also the tension of shame or embarrassment. He kept talking embarrassment. We look for those tensions. I would like to have you just write a short paragraph, a sentence or so, defining the central tension that lies within the subject, what you just wrote about. What is the tension in that issue? What are the forces that are in conflict? When I was young, I hated the limitations, any kind of edges, any kind of frames, any kind of traditions, and fought against them. And in general, I think that's healthy and natural, and I still sort of do that. I'm much more comfortable when I found out that I didn't have to wear a tie and a jacket. And some of the more trivial conventions of our society I like to rail against. But I fought the traditions of school and the habits of school, the traditions of theology, the traditions of government, trying to find out where the horizons were. And although that is all good and natural, and I would encourage it, I've come to understand the importance of limits and the advantages of limits, that those of us who are professional narrow the frame. And we narrow the frame in our writing for a very good reason. We do not write about the United States. We are more likely to write about our state, or our town, or our neighborhood, a house, a room in the house, one part of that room, an afternoon in the corner of the room. I wrote once, instead of writing about shyness, I wrote about the closet I used to hide in when company came, and how uncomfortable it was to sit on shoes, and the smell of all this old shoe polish, and the murmured voices that I would hear downstairs, and my realization that I would be in trouble again because I was so shy. Obviously, I have overcome my shyness, as I have overcome my problem of being excessively thin when I was young. So I would write about the specific details in writing a novel that is involved in part with the war and being in combat in World War II. You don't write about big strategic issues as much as you write about one moment, one time here, one incident, one little tiny landscape. So I would like to have you try to make a sentence or a note of instruction to yourself as how you could limit your subject in time or space or subject matter so that you would have more depth. As you limit the subject, you can see more. You're all very camera literate in this age. What I'm talking about is the close-up. That when you come in with the lens that brings you in close to the subject, you can see the wrinkles in the face. You can see the way the beard twists. You can see the eyes behind the glasses. You can really look in close, and you do that by zooming in. So I want you to make a note on how you can increase the limits on your subject so that you can go into the subject more deeply. What I'm trying to do, obviously, is take you into the writer's world, take you into the writer's notebook, into the writer's head, to making the notes. How can I handle the subject? How can I deal with it? Another way of getting an edge is by shifting the angle of vision. One of my favorite quotations is from Cezanne. I could keep myself busy for months without moving from one spot, just by leaning now to the right, now to the left. I want to repeat that. I could keep myself busy for months without moving from one spot, just by leaning now to the right, now to the left. If I move over here, it becomes a different audience. And there are people on both sides of the aisle. And the light, as I move, the shadows on the light are different. Your faces are all different. There's a different pattern to you. If I move in the other way, this section, there's nobody over here. And as soon as I get over by this way, you are all on one side from me. And it's just amazing to me, again, I do this, and I see again the shadows and the lights in your face are entirely different in here. So we take and look at the subject from a different angle. I thought I had a terrible childhood. My mother thought that she gave me the ideal childhood. And I think we can write from many different perspectives. You write from the perspective of yourself as young, looking up at people, or later looking down. One of the terrible moments of my life is my father did on occasion beat me. I understand why he beat me, because my grandmother dominated the house, and it was a matriarchal society, and she dominated my mother, who in turn dominated my father, who in turn beat me. It was perfectly natural. I think I understood this. I didn't like it. There were some wonderful triumphs. He was very active in the Baptist church, and the time that I yelled and the police came to the house before he got hold of me was a wonderful, wonderful success, because he was so embarrassed. The Irish Catholic policeman came and told him not to beat his child, and he hadn't yet beaten me. That was a big victory. But the sad time was when I grew tall, and he stayed the same, and one day he came to beat me, and I backed up all the way through this tenement we lived in. And at the end of it, I said, if you take another step, I will cold cock you. And I waited for this moment. I'd waited for years, and he seemed to shrink in front of me. He never touched me again. He turned away, and I was infinitely sad. Now, I could write about that from my point of view, as I just have. I could write about it from my father's point of view, from my father's point of view towards his father. There must have been a history I could make up. His father was a very violent man. I could write about it from my mother's point of view. I could write it from my grandmother, who must have witnessed it from her bed. She was paralyzed, but she would have heard all this. I could have, there's a many different ways. You could tell the story from the police or from a neighbor who might have heard it. Everything can be seen as we take pictures from different angles. We can tell stories from different angles. So I'd like to have you write down at least one other angle of vision from which you could tell your story. I want you to try writing with your eyes shut, and to explain that concept, I'll have to go off a little bit. Charlie Simic, who has got the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry this year, and who is on our faculty, he also got one of those MacArthur grants, or genius grants, which are wonderful to get. Very fine man, wonderful person. He talked about, in a poetry lecture, writing with your eyes open and writing with the eyes shut. And I think that that's an interesting distinction. If you don't understand quite what I mean, that's good too. It's the kind of powerful idea that can't be fully understood. But if I were to describe my high school corridor with my eyes open, trying to write with accurate detail, and this is something that I try to do, and I'm proud of doing, a description that is accurate in observation is important, I would write, North Quincy High School's corridors were dimly lit, but the floors and woodwork were so highly polished that the square of pale outside light made it through a classroom and out the door's window ricocheted from one surface to another. And I think I've begun to caught that kind of highly polished school situation where the floors and the walls and everything are polished and light reflects back and forth. If I were going to write that with my eyes shut, this is what I might write. Some days when I use the Forge Corridor Pass to escape class and wander the corridors of North Quincy High School, they were narrow tunnels, and I would edge along carefully, fearful that they would close down and I would not be able to breathe. Today they were filled with Arctic space, and I could not, no matter how long I grew my arms, touch either wall. In other words, this is more free. It's open. I was writing the feelings when I remembered that and shut my eyes to the detail, but put myself in that situation and recorded the experience I had at that moment. So I would like to have you write very quickly with your eyes shut. One thing that I've become increasingly interested in writing is fast writing. I think it is as important to have velocity in writing as it is in riding a bicycle. You can't balance a bicycle unless you get up to speed. And I don't think you can write well unless you write fast. If you write fast, you will have a lot of errors. You will have errors of penmanship. When I was writing fast earlier, I couldn't read it. No matter, I'll make up the words, read another one. You'll have errors of grammar, errors of spelling. I certainly will, because I'm a very poor speller. Errors of punctuation. This is not what you would pass in. But to get a draft down, to get some speed on the thing, I could never throw a curve. And the reason I couldn't throw a curve, I wasn't strong enough to throw the ball fast enough to have it do anything. I could get it to the plate if I was lucky, but it certainly couldn't have any hop or twist or drop or anything on it. So that you want to get enough speed in your writing so that you have accidents. What kind of accidents? Accidents of insight. You discover something that you didn't expect to discover. And accidents of language, so you use words that seem to be the wrong words and turn out maybe to be the right words. So you want to create accident in writing, and therefore you want to write as fast as you can. So I'd like to have you just write now a few lines on the same piece as fast as you can, so it's uncomfortable. By underwriting, writing as starkly and minimal as you can. Another way is what I call extravagantism, where you write as richly and extremely and inflated diction and try just on both sides to see when you put in everything that you possibly can. These will give you things that you can, in one case, build up, in another case, cut down. You want to make connections. Forrester said, only connect. And I think it's true. You want to connect these other things. I wrote a piece here connecting my high school experience to my wartime experience. And you want to make these connections too. You want to push to the edge with genre. You should try different kinds of writing. If you've never written a poem, go and write a poem. Write a memo. Write a screenplay. Write a short story. Write an essay. Write a sermon, write anything at all. Keep moving through different genres. Each genre, each form of writing is another lens. If you have a camera, you want to have a zoom lens, you want to have a close-up lens, you want to have a wide-angle lens. This is what genre is. You see the experience in different ways. I write about things in the column in the Boston Globe. I write about them in textbooks. I write about them in fiction. I write about them in poetry. And not enough writers, I think, have the fun of this. Writers get narrowly declared they're a poet, or they're a novelist, or they're a short story writer, or they're a nonfiction writer, and they get frozen in the same way we get frozen in courses. So we should do that. One thing I did was very quickly wrote a draft of a poem on the same kind of high school experience. I've been thinking a lot about twins, and last night I wrote one twin poem. This is another twin poem. My stranger twin. In seventh grade, we moved across the city and I met my stranger twin. Won a curbstone fist fight the first hour. Observed my twin converse with girls, sass teachers, tell locker room jokes at lunch, swagger down unfamiliarities to home where I could listen to silence, enter a book or sit in the shadows hidden by a lace curtain, watch my twin's new street friends at their terrifying play. I'm trying to capture in that, or I found I've captured, I didn't try to do anything except just write and see what happened, that tension that I think so many of us feel between the private, reflective person and the public person that we have to become in life. That the person that can, I got involved in youth religious groups so I could stand up in front of 15 or 20 people and not completely come apart. I was so shy, I forced myself to do this. And now, of course, I can do it to a lot of people Now my problem is not to babble so much and to stay home and write and cultivate the private person, but there is that conflict between the public person and the private person, and genre has helped me do that. The most important thing in writing of all, and the way to push the edge, is with voice. I think that that is the one element we see in writing. If you think of it, we have a heard quality off the page. If we trust a writer, it's because the writer has articulated our feelings in a voice we can understand, a voice we trust, a voice we believe in. It's voice that takes us to certain writers, it's voice that turns us away from certain writers. We want to have a voice, a music in our writing. We want to have a heard quality in our writing that is like us. I hope that Jim, who's known me so long, would hear me talking here and say, that's the same Don Murray that I knew, the same Don Murray that was at dinner at his house last night. It's the same person, the same voice. It's projected differently. If I talked like this at dinner, everybody would stop throwing rolls at me. But essentially, it's the same person. The voice that you hear in my books, I hope, is the voice that you hear today. You should listen to your text. You should write out loud. I'd like to have you continue this by writing it in different voices, changing the audience. Write in the voice that you would write in if you were at church, visiting your grandmother in a nursing home, if you're on the playground, if you're talking to your best friend. As the father of daughters, it always fascinated me to hear the voices without overhearing what they were saying. They would meet a boy, and they'd have a phone call with him, and over a period of weeks, the voice would change. It's become more comfortable, more familiar. The voices, the music from the other room. One of my daughters has brought home a young man, and they're becoming very serious about each other, and I was interested in hearing from the kitchen not what they were saying, but the relaxed way in which they talked to each other, the casual, comfortable way. And I thought that was as good a sign that this may be as good a relationship as anything else, because they were natural with each other. And so these voices, we want to hear a voice that's appropriate. Play around with voice. Write out loud. Push the voice. Push the voice. Be angry. Be nostalgic. Be instructive. Be didactic. Sermonize. You know, confess. Try all these different voices we have. Every one of us comes to school at the first grade with an enormous spectrum of voices. And we should build on that and take those qualities in our voice that are strong. Another thing that I want to say from this is that if you want to become a good writer, of course you want to ultimately eliminate error that gets in the way of meaning, breaking of tradition that doesn't clarify, but concentrate on what works for you. In any kind of art, you will succeed as you extend what is good in your writing. The same way in athletics. I was made a right tackle. Why? Because I was big and bulky, and before the age of contact lenses was blind. I could throw a football very well, but I couldn't tell which team I was throwing it to. So I was made a right tackle. I am not a ballet dancer. We pick all sort of things in life. We go with our strengths. And this is what you should do in your writing, is to go with your strength and develop and extend your strength. And ultimately, by going to the extent of finding your edges, finding the horizons of your writing, you will get to those areas of mystery that are terribly important. Truman Capote said, if there's no mystery for the artist to solve inside of his art, there's no point in it. Grace Paley says, we write about what we don't know about what we know. And Don Barthelme says, art is not difficult because it wishes to be difficult, rather because it wishes to be art. However much the writer might long to be in his work simple, honest, straightforward, these virtues are no longer available to him. He discovers that being simple, honest, straightforward, nothing much happens. He speaks the unspeakable. Whereas we are looking for the as-yet unspeakable, the as-yet unspoken. So I urge you to look for those mysteries, those edges, those places of conflict within your own writing, and those strengths within yourself, and bring the strengths that are yours together with the questions that you need to answer and deal with in your writing. And I hope this will now lead to some questions that we can have more of a discussion than a lecture. Thank you.
impress people, particularly when I try to impress somebody I don't like, somebody I'm competitive with, somebody I want to show off for. I want to write like somebody I'm not. I want to write a subject that is not my subject, or I want to write in a voice that is not mine. In school, unfortunately, there are times when you have to write for teachers in styles that are not yours. This is part of education, to try on these different styles. And we have to teach that, and so we have to put students in that position. But what I try to do is to write for myself in my own way, and to lower my standards. William Stafford had very, very wise advice about lowering your standards. If you're going to do something, if you're going to learn to cook, if you're going to learn to run or something, if you're going to be a marathoner, you probably don't run 26 miles a day. You have to begin to find out how you can ride a mile, and then maybe extend it to 3 miles, and then 7 miles. And so in writing, you have to get your standards down until there is a text. The discoveries we make from writing are not thought out beforehand, as I've mentioned. The discoveries of writing come from the accidents on a page. And so you have to be able to get your standards low enough to get the accidents on a page to get a draft. Other things I do when I'm stuck on writing, I move to a different subject or a different form. If I'm writing poetry and it's not working, I may try a short story or an essay. If I'm start a column and that doesn't work, I may start a column on a different subject and see if that works. I may almost do a kind of free writing, nonsense writing, to see if it works with language. I've dictated. I used to dictate a lot of work to my wife, and that became a way of getting over the blocking that was going on. I wanted the text to be too good, and I wanted to worry about spelling and punctuation and typing too early. Those things need to be worried about. So if I dictated, I would be able to babble. I found out often that the babbling was pretty disciplined. Speak orally into a tape recorder, then take it down from the tape recorder. Change the different techniques you use. If you use the writing with a pen, try typing. Computer, try a different. Terrifying for me, because it's one thing for you if you're a student and have no intention of being a writer. Then if you say, well, that's just not for me, the way I said math wasn't. Science wasn't for me, but my whole life is right. If I feel that the well is drawing up, it's very frightening. So I have to know these devices. Okay.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I didn't get that on right. Thank you. The suggestions in terms of the writing block that I've just made?
The suggestions you've made in pushing the edge.
Oh.
What are the advantages for a student in approaching their writing with these things in mind as opposed to some other things?
Oh, learning. That writing for the writer is not writing down what you have already thought. It's doing the thinking in public. It's making the thinking possible. Writing is the most disciplined form of thinking that we know. And therefore, if you push the edge, you'll learn something. The difference is very simple. If you take a course in Civil War history and you've been a buff of Civil War history and you write a paper that you already know all the answers, you may get an A, but you won't learn anything. If you go to the edge and try to approach the subject in a different way, then you may learn something. I think if you're going to try to break the traditions within the academy, then you better discuss it with your teacher early on. There are not many teachers and not many editors that are prepared to be surprised. And if you are going to write your Civil War paper as a narrative or as an interview with General Sheridan or in some form that may be instructive for you, it's better that you prepare your teacher for this and get permission. And many teachers will give permission if they understand the reasons for the experiment. If you say, I've read a lot of books on this, I've written some papers on the Civil War in high school, and it seems to me that I would learn more by attempting this, I think most teachers would allow it. It depends. It depends on certain courses you have. The teacher is under instruction to teach certain skills, and maybe they won't. But I think that if you can go to the edge in any of these ways, you will find that you're surprised, and surprise is learning. You will find that you're saying things that you don't expect to say, and that's what writing is all about. Takes a little courage, takes a little initiative, but it's all right. Once you try a little courage, you find you have a little more courage the next time.
Do you get feedback on your writing, or do you pretty much use yourself as your own judge?
I depend a lot on feedback, but I'm very careful about it. It's a very good question. I don't show the earliest drafts to people. When I finish a draft, I show it to my wife, who's my first reader. She has some marvelous ability. She can actually spell. I have so much trouble with spelling that I can't find it on the spell check. I have a bad speller's dictionary because I, you know, you look up pneumonia. Where would you look up pneumonia? Under N, of course. I have a dictionary that has it under N, and so I can do it. And she tells me in not so subtle terms whether it makes any sense or not. Her enthusiasm ranges from this is okay, right, until I think this is pretty good to I'm not sure about this. But I show her a lot of stuff. It's important for me to get a reading from her. It's important for me to share it with, I cultivate my editors on the column. I have Evelyn Kramer as an editor now, who is extremely good on the Boston Globe. I'm very fortunate to have her. I try to get to know my editors for my books and call them up and get to know them as a person and encourage them to change things. I have a book coming out in a few weeks now, and a new editor took over, and she was very shy about changing things that a writer said, and I kept encouraging her, I need you, help me, don't overlook anything. And she found some very, very grievous errors of the text that had been seen by other editors, and I was able to correct them. I need that kind of reading. I don't go to readers who don't make me, let me put it differently, I get so tangled in a sentence. I want to leave you, if you're my reader, wanting to write. As a teacher, I wanted my students to leave me wanting to write. And I don't tend to show my work to people who don't put me in a position where I'm enthusiastic about writing if I don't have to. I may have to work for editors, or you may have to work for teachers that don't have this impact. That's the reality of the world. But the readers I choose, my peers, the people I would show it to at a dorm, the people I would show it to in the family, I want to get a good feeling at the end. They can be very critical, but they don't destroy me. It's a very complicated question. I try to protect myself. I spent too much time accepting the opinion of people that I shouldn't have accepted it. For literally decades, I paid too much attention to criticism. So many people have their own ideas about what you should do. People have read my poetry back a ways and said, you're a big guy, you should write big poetry. Now, this is a kind of sexist or poetry by weight thing. You know, it's like saying that a nice girl like you shouldn't write a poem like this, or should write a poem like that, or this subject's appropriate to you or not appropriate to you. Those kind of judgments where somebody puts, this is the kind of book we want. Since this is a Christian college, you mentioned, that's one of the conflicts for the writer. Do you write what you need to write, what you are told to write by your theology, or do you repeat what other people say should be in a Christian book? That's a very difficult conflict, as many of you know. That's the same way if you're writing under any organizational kind of restriction. You've got to accept that world. Yes, you want to write as a Christian, but you don't necessarily want to write exactly the same way as every other Christian has previously written, or there'd be no point to it. So you have tradition and the pushing of tradition, not the breaking of it as much as the pushing of it. So you have to be careful. People will, you know, somebody will say you would just read, say, a manuscript of yours and say, this isn't a Christian short story. I would be rather skeptical about that reading. That means that that person, who may be a very good person, has very rigid ideas that are imposed on the story, and they're not really listening to the story. And that's why Graham Greene or Flannery O'Connor, that are described as Catholic writers, or when you have, Sharon Olds is a favorite poet of mine, or Nancy Mayers or somebody else is told as a female writer or a woman writer. We have to have these categories, but everybody shivers. I would hate to be known as a male writer. I'm a heterosexual, but I'd hate to be known as a heterosexual writer. It seems outrageous, yet we have gay literature. I think that would be awfully restrictive. I certainly think that people who are gay should write. I'm not sure I would want to be trapped into writing a kind of literature that's predisposed, or capitalist literature, or communist literature. So I think that you want to be careful about those critics that come with a very strong idea of what you should do. And I would pay not too much attention to them. But I'd pay attention. The other thing about criticism is that in writing, we all try to get by with things we shouldn't. And when somebody says, I think this character's weak, or those lines don't work for me, or these images are kind of silly, there are times I say, yeah, immediately, you caught me out. You found out. I was trying to push it. I was not careful. I knew that was pretty silly. Then I pay attention. On the other hand, if I think that's my strength, and if I really have considered it, I will stick with it. There's no absolutes, but it is that kind of tension. The whole tension in writing is between freedom and discipline. And it's also between tradition and the individual. So as an individual, you have to be strong, but within a tradition. You can't let the tradition completely surround you, or you will only do what has been done in the past, saying it the way it's been said before, and it'll be just stamping it out. That's no good. On the other hand, if you're totally individualistic, you'll speak to yourself. And some people are that way. There was a man in town, I don't know whether you know him, I could mention his name, but I won't hear on audio mic, a very sincere and a very wonderful person who bought to me a book of religious poems. And I read them and tried to understand them and couldn't. And I agonized about this. I read them over and over again, and they just didn't make any sense to me, theologically or aesthetically or any way. They were incoherent to me. And we had the appointment to meet and talk about these, and I was very sensitive to the fact that I wanted to say, I don't understand them. He was very pleased that I don't understand them. He intended to write them for a very small audience. He buried them in various places in the country in lead boxes so that they would be discovered after the world's end and a new world started, and those people would understand them. So it was a very peculiar audience situation. And I'm sure they will, and I congratulated him and sent him on his way. He didn't want my criticism, and he didn't need it, and that's fine. I'm very happy with a lot of diversity.
As far as using experimental writing in an academic setting, you're talking about a lot of failure in your experiments.
Yeah.
Much as it's a great learning experience, you're talking about, it seems you would have to sacrifice the quote-unquote academic success. And I still don't see how that would mesh. And ideologically, it sounds great, exciting, but it still seems like you have to be safe in order to make it through and get where you want to go.
My experience would be, in general, in the academic world, that you have to play it safe to get B minus and B. But the A's take some risks, the good writers, the William Faulkner is either an A or an F. He isn't a B minus C plus writer, and so you have to take and have enough courage to do some daring. It may be private. I mean, we do a lot of things. You pick certain teachers, you extend certain things, and you take your chances when you can. I found my daughter in high school doing something that chilled me. Some of her friends were doing. They were writing the paper as good as they could, writing just the way they thought they should be writing. And then they would write them the way they thought they were worst, and they were passing in the worst ones and getting A's. There's a lot of games that go on, and as you learn your way between the freedoms and the disciplines, if you are going to be the kind of person that that's going to extend the discipline, then you may have to wait your time. The column I do at the Globe, I could never have written as a beginning reporter. They would never have let me write it, but they let me write it now. And so you may have to take your time and hone your skills and see what you can learn and move on. But I think if you just write for entirely, do all your work for external rewards and external instruction, you won't be learning. I don't think this is easy by any means. It isn't easy for me at 66. I have people turn my stuff down. I'm more worried in my own case about being traditional, since I know the traditional so well, and pleasing without meaning to please, instead of writing what I should write in the way it should be written. But that tension's always going to be there. And those persons that want to be artists and want to do what hasn't been done before are always going to call down some criticism on themselves, because people don't particularly like surprises. When, you know, tell me a story, Daddy, we read to kids, read me a story. They want to be read the Three Little Bears or something over and over and over again. We all have that part in us. You look at TV, people want the familiar. There's a rock cop show on TV that I probably will never look at because I'm narrow-minded and bigoted and don't want detectives on my TV set singing rock lyrics, you know. Other people think it's the most wonderful thing that happens, so fine. You know? I think you just have to find your way in that. It's a kind of lonely road, but if you go the way of total rejection, you learn nothing. And if you go the way of total acceptance, you learn nothing, so you have to find your way. And I think as a teacher, I wanted to be surprised more than my students knew that I wanted to be surprised. But obviously, if you're going to turn a term paper in that's a poem, you better let me know about it in advance. We ought to talk about it. You were going to go to the microphone.
I've got three different viewpoints of the same piece here in my hand. And I just want to know, what do you do? Pick one when you've finally written 18 viewpoints and then decide which one is best, and then do you spend as much time polishing that as far as word choice, sentence structures go, as you did in finding it, or what process follows? Okay. This is what I want to know.
I pick the one to work on when you have an alternative of ways. It depends on the subject. If I'm writing a memo to a dean for money, I will pick the memo approach that I think will persuade him to give me the money. That will be audience directed. I've done some ghostwriting for corporations and for governments. And in that case, the audience is extremely important. If it's a poem, on the other hand, I would pick the one that seems right to me in the purest sense, the one that seems to express the tension, explore the tension, or the truth, if you want, that I want to explore. And I would look at the one that seems to give me the most opportunity for exploration and growth, the one that challenges me the most, that's just a little beyond my achievement. There's a fellow who's written a book on psychology. I can't think of the name. I could never pronounce his name. It's about this long. I get to Jim. It's a Polish name that goes on and on and on. It's got something like 30 letters in it. And he's done a lot of studies at the University of Chicago of artists, finding very interesting things following their careers. And one thing he has found is that artists are those people that find a problem to solve in what other people think is ordinary, which is very interesting. Somebody else goes by a pile of bottles that are cracked and broken and outside and somewhere in a garbage can and sees a bunch of beer bottles that are dirty. And the artist says, gee, look at those shades of green. And starts a painting of all those different reflected greens. It's that kind of thing. The other thing he's written a lot about is flow. And flow is that area in which we see in sports. If you are a skier, you're in the flow when you are capable of doing what you're doing, but barely capable of it. When the challenge is great, but achievable. In other words, if I were to ski down a slope, it would be just chaos. I go down head over heels. But you want to be in the flow. You want to be able to have a very challenging job, and you want to have the capability of doing it and be right on the edge between the two. This is something that interests me. So I would pick that thing that I think, yeah, I think I can now write this poem. And I'd try it out, you see. That would have some hazards. I wouldn't write the poem I'd just written. And most forms are in between that. You pick the one that itches you. A lot of our writing is personal. in the sense that we have a need to persuade somebody else not to smoke or to join our church or to vote the way we vote or to, there may be personal, and just to solve a problem in our lives and to ask a question that is very close to us. And so we pick and write that thing that we need to write. And this may be apart from whether the audience needs it and apart whether the form may be fairly conventional and experienced, but if I need to deal with this subject of abortion or the subject of sending medicines to make people healthy that are not going to make them healthy to other countries, then I have to deal with that. And I would be willing to use quite traditional forms of writing to satisfy the need to explore the subject and communicate it. So it's a lot of things. It comes down to a very personal feeling, a very personal saying, yeah, this is what I'll write today. And I may write it another day, another way. I might write it in a different form. I may find a different thing. I never feel that I have to be loyal to what I've written. Elizabeth Bones said that disloyalty is as much a virtue in a writer as loyalty is in a soldier. In a sense, the writer has to stand aside not only from society and from people and look, it's a kind of lonely thing, has to stand aside from himself or herself and to separate himself or herself from that work that has just been done. I've just written, published the ninth or tenth book on how to write, and I don't read the other books when I write them. When I write a new edition, I tend to separate myself from a previous edition and talk about what I'm learning today. That doesn't mean that what I wrote about 3 years ago isn't valid and that what I write about 3 years from now won't be valid. But I've got to concentrate on what I know that day, what interests me. Velocity, I mentioned today, is something. The fast writing interests me. The flow of writing interests me. Going to the edge interests me. These are ideas that, as Jim mentioned, are rehearsed in class and rehearsed in talks and rehearsed in articles and coming books. It's what is itching me at this moment. Very personal question. What you want to work on at this time. And then if you're taking a course, then you've got to find out if the professor will allow you to scratch that itch in that class. It's reality.
As a novelist, do you think it's important to have a daily writing routine?
Yes. At the moment, I'm not practicing it. I think it's important to be in the habit of writing, and yes, to keep a book going, I think you need to do something every day. If you write a page a day, you will have a 365-page book at the end of a year. I think that most of us need to be writing daily to contain that kind of overtext, the vision of the whole in our head, and we need to make some daily progress. Most writers count words or pages to stay away, as I mentioned last night, from the question of whether it's good or bad, and to make some progress. You don't get up every morning, feeling like, I know that all of you leap out of bed saying, boy, I can hardly wait to get to class. I know the teachers certainly feel that way when they get up in the morning. And writers, of course, leap out of bed saying, boy, I'm going to write. We don't, so we have to have habit. And I try to get down in the morning. I try to practice that Horace, Pliny, and other people have said, nulla dies in a linea, never a day without a line. And I think it's particularly true on a novel or any book. It's like a marathon runner. You have to run every day. You don't necessarily run the whole marathon every day, but you have to be in the act of running. And so each day I try to advance it. Now, I'm using a technique that I'd like to take a minute to talk about, is what I call layering. The way I'm writing the novel is to write over what I've written before, and I urge you to try this. And actually, some teachers I've worked with have done it at very early, with very elementary, primary school children, have them write the same thing over. It's really what I started with here, is to write over. On a computer, it's very easy, but you can do it by hand. And so I put up the beginning of the chapter, and I start writing it. And one day, dialogue will come. Another day, I'll see I need description. Another day, I'll realize the proportions are wrong, and the pace is wrong. Pace and proportion is something I don't think we talk enough about in writing, and most textbooks don't talk about those. You got to move fast enough so that the audience is with you. You got to move slow enough so they can absorb it. that, you know, my tension, obviously, a day, I realized when I went down and spoke to Jim, I wasn't quite sure when the class was going to leave, and so I changed the pace and tried to catch them and got the back of their heads on the last item. But you change the pace for the audience. But I was working slowly, and I'm glad that I did, so that those points that I made, you had a chance to think about and work with and evolve. So you always have pace and proportion. So one day I'll make the chapter faster, one day I'll make it slower. I'll develop it, give it more texture. And so I write over it and over it, and finally I come to the end and say, that's it, and I won't look back, and I go to the next chapter. Now, how do I know when it's finished? I know when it's finished when I come to deadline. And if I have an opportunity, I'll rewrite it. I once did a survey at our campus to all the people who had published books in a recent time that I could find in the sciences, in history, in philosophy, in psychology, and in English literature, and creative writing. And all of them had rewritten their books after acceptance. After a publisher said, yes, I'll publish it, they'd all rewritten it. It would never stop unless you have a deadline. So I make arbitrary deadlines. I had two batches of poetry, about 12 poems, come back from two different publications that clearly don't understand the most important things that are going on in American literature. And so they rejected me, and I made a deadline. Before I leave to go to Rochester and Houghton, I will get these two batches of poetry in the mail. And as I left town, they went in the mailbox. There's no aesthetic reason for them to go in the mailbox at that time. It's just arbitrarily. So I'll say, I'm going to finish this. I'm going to finish this novel by the end of the year, because there's no great deadline on that from anyone else. If I, the column obviously has a deadline. I set my deadline. It's a column appears every other week. I set my deadline a week ahead and try to deliver it before Wednesday of the week that will appear on Tuesday, 8 days ahead, 7 days ahead. Just so I give myself room, so if the editor or if I decide that it isn't work, I've got time to do another one. So you set deadlines.
I don't believe I'm quite getting the layering idea of how you actually work this. For example, if I put something up on a computer screen, and I start playing with it, I mean, I could play with that thing and massage it forever and ever.
I suspect that the difference would be, and I may be wrong, but from your training, that you would be prematurely concerned with spelling and correctness of sentence structure and punctuation and paragraph length, where I would be more concerned with the music of the text, with giving the reader more information. The inexperienced writer tends to give the reader too little information, and I find that I have to encourage my students and people I work with in experience to give me more information, to make it really work for me. And so that much of it is, I have this idea that it will be very important to the novel. It'll be a scene that will be one or two lines long, or, you know, and then that will expand and expand, you see. If you're going to have a character that says to, that they meet on a date, and he is going to say, I don't want to see you anymore, and she comes with her own messages that she's pregnant. You can't have that, and you could do it in two lines. I don't want to see you anymore. I'm pregnant. You know, that isn't going to work. And so what you have to do is to set this up, to let you know what kind of person this is, and what kind of person she is, what kind of person he is, what kind of world do they live in, what kind of relationship do they have. If one of them believes strongly in abortion and one of them believes strongly against abortion, that has to be prepared so that the reader recognizes these things and that you move on. And there has to go to resolution. So these two lines have grown in terms of to a chapter, a short story, whatever, a play. You know. Now, what would happen with me is that I probably one morning I would particularly identify with the woman, and I would spend a lot of details about what she says and what she doesn't say and what she thinks and what the action is. There might be some body language that they come together in. You know, it might be in the head of the point of view of the guy and he sees her step back. Or she says things that are not directly things. She might say at first, I just heard from my sister. She's pregnant. And she's looking to see whether he thinks that's a good thing. If he says, oh my God, then she knows and the reader knows that they're likely to be in trouble. If he says, gee, that's wonderful, you know, then maybe it would be. So it's that kind of development that extends the text. And I'm willing to let one part of the text be very primitive while another is developed. Then the next day I do it. On the screen, you can just go right over it. I would destroy a lot of stuff. I did some public writing in Rochester, and some of the people were surprised that I just cut things out. I would be very much more willing to cut things out than the amateur would believe in a form. So it's a matter of trying to get the truth at the truth, to get into these people. It isn't enough to have them have that human problem of getting pregnant before you plan it. They could be married. It could be a career choice. It doesn't need to be a question of an illegitimate child. It could be a question that she plans to go to law school, that this is going to change that. Or it could be that he plans to go to law school and he's going to live on her job and now she doesn't have a job. Now we aren't in any questions of morality or question, it's just simply timing and priorities between human beings and which one will support the other, you see. These are the things that'll come. The woman in my novel started out, I'm in 18 chapters, she was an artist. She went from being an artist to being a lawyer. She went from being a lawyer to being a social worker. Now she's a retired English teacher in 18 chapters. That you discover the book through this layering. I hear what she's saying. In one novel that I published, a character was Jewish. How did I know he was Jewish? From his sense of humor, from the way he spoke, and I changed his name. He had an Anglo name, and I changed it to a Jewish name, the opposite of what we often see happening, because he was Jewish. I discovered he was Jewish by getting to know him. And so that's what I'm doing that might be different. And the same thing is true if I'm writing a book about revision, as I just did. I may have a chapter that's talking about organizational revision or voice, revision by voice, and I have a few things to say in the beginning. And as I expand and develop them, I discover I have other things to say. And so it's working with the ideas. And then at the end, it certainly is working with following every tradition of language that clarifies and breaking the tradition of language when it doesn't clarify. I could say, I don't know no grammar, and it would be correct if I'm trying to demonstrate that my knowledge of grammar is very primitive or absorbed as a writer. I speak and write grammatically, but I don't know the names. I wouldn't know a gerund if it sat down beside me. I'm not sure what a past participle is, and I'm not sure if there is a present participle, come to think of it, or a future participle. I knew names at one time, but you don't need to know names when you're doing it all the time. And so I say, I don't know no grammar. Could be a grammatical statement because I'm using it for emphasis rhetorically in a talk. I've used the word thunk. You don't write what you've thunk. And I use the past tense, an incorrect past tense, to get the reader's attention. And to snap them up a little bit and to make the point, and then it's okay to use it, or it can be or may not be.
What do you write, when you were teaching writing, did you write in the margins, in your students' papers? If so, what sorts of comments? If not, how do you respond
to the paper? Taught by conference, and we had a 15-minute conference with every student. Depending on your teaching load, how many can you do is a question, but I did not read the papers carefully before I conversed with students. I read them quickly because I was curious to say, how did this person develop? We would have a conference about which idea you chose, and I could not read your paper because I'm itchy to see whether you chose the one I wished you chose or whether you chose someone else and why. And so I'm curious, I develop a curiosity. If you did some revision after the talk we just had, I'd have to read your paper and I'd scan it. I would very carefully not mark it up. That was my style. I'm not saying this should be anybody else. Why? Because I want to teach the student to read. I want to teach the student to read a paper so that that student can make their paper better. And so I want the student to tell me in conference what they think of the paper. And if they don't know what to tell me, the first kind of questions I would ask is, what surprised you? What did you learn? What was different than you expected on the paper? I would ask you what works and later what needs work. Writing improves by extending the good things in the paper, I think, more than the bad. But I need to know what you think of papers. You have a lot of factors that come into the writing conference. 9 out of 10 of my students that were good writers were women. I think this is true because women have to learn 2 languages. Those of you who are women have had to learn male language and female language, just for openers. Males can speak just male language in our society, though this is changing greatly as you start to have women executives, and department chairpersons, and editors, and people have to learn that. But to the present, generally, women have been more skillful in language. However, women have been socialized to be modest and demure, and so you get a woman coming in with X paper, and you say, what do you think of it? And they say, oh, no, I don't think it's very good. I can't write. And you get X paper, the same paper passed into somebody who comes in for soccer practice, and they say it's great because the man has been socialized on the playground to take an aggressive stance. And so you ask a question, you'll get a defensive answer. So you have to get through all these kind of levels of things to hear what does this person really say about the paper and to make it constructive. And so I listen. In recent years, what I've done is to have my students write a commentary on the paper. A paragraph or so they pass in with it saying what they learned in writing the paper or what conditions it was written under or whatever, something that tells me something about the paper. Incidentally, I'm writing with them whatever I'm writing. If I'm teaching news writing and I might be writing poetry, I'll share that. And I would write commentaries too if I did this. And then we would share the commentaries in class or in conference. I would read what the student thinks. If a student thinks this is a terrible paper, and says, why? I got so carried away with my subject, I became totally incoherent. It's like a train wreck. Then I read it, and I agree. I say, good, good, good attempt, but yeah, I agree. This is a train wreck. What are you going to do now? It's very inductive. I think students at every level, I talk to students the first grade, second grade, third grade, they can talk about their papers. And you can just, and they say, gee, well, what are you going to do now? Well, I think you need more information if you're going to understand that this is a porcupine, not a raccoon. You know, so, well, give me some more information. and it's that kind of inductive teaching that I did. I tried not to write on the papers because that wasn't helpful. I don't have any great philosophical feeling about this. I found that editors who write a lot of my papers and teachers didn't understand why I did what I did. People always do things for reasons. The previous instruction from some other teacher misunderstood, or for some reason they think this kind of paper has to have big words. They use Roget's thesaurus and use words they don't have any understanding of because they've been told that inflated diction is good and rewarded for it in another class. I have to know, why did you do this? Why are you writing this way? And then I can help them write the way that I think, in my own subjective way, is more effective. So that's the way I taught. I found it very satisfying, demanding, but different kind of teaching. I did not spend as much time in preparation as my literature colleagues did. I spent more time, as Jim mentioned, in contact. And I would have, in my case, between 65 and 120 conferences a week, depending on how much administration I was doing. I was a department chairperson, and I ran. Our freshman English program meant that you had 60 people you were supervising. So there were things like that that took time. But I found it immensely satisfying. Another way of putting this, and I think it's extremely important, that when I had a conference with Jim or with Donna, they were teaching me. They were teaching me the subject, and I maybe was teaching them writing. Jim could teach me a lot about how to stack boxes of shoes at the Timberland factory. And I would learn a lot about what it's like to work in Timberland, down in Newmarket, down the road, and who the people were and how they related to each other. And I would be learning about that. And I hope my reactions would help him learn to write that more effectively. And so in the conference, the student becomes the teacher, teacher becomes the learner, models how to learn. I would also show students my own papers, and the role would reverse. So that, and then we'd have peer conferences and the whole thing. But I have a lot of respect for the potential of the students. That did not mean I gave all A's. It didn't mean I had no standards at the end of the course. At the end of the semester in my courses, you picked your best papers, three papers usually, and you were graded on them, and you were graded by the standards, but you weren't graded in the beginning, because then you're grading what has been learned before, I think. But that's my philosophy that evolved. When I started teaching writing, I taught in the traditional way. I marked the papers up. I gave grades immediately, got everybody in line, gave a lot of D's and F's, and they knew I was a good teacher because they were terrified. And I was a very, very traditional teacher, and people urged me to question. I used to figure out every year what worked in the course I took and then eliminated it. And I found that, for example, in journalism, I wasn't teaching skills so much as attitudes. That my students in journalism went out and they weren't surprised when the city editor asked them to do what they did. You can't possibly recreate in one semester or two what goes on in a week in a newspaper. But you can teach certain skills and you can teach attitudes around those skills. And I learned that by eliminating. I gave a two-semester course in journalism back in 63. And I had an exam at the end, a final exam, which now seems bizarre to me. And the students did pretty well. And I had a reputation very quickly of being a good teacher because I was organized. If you want to get a reputation in a school of being a good teacher, be organized, because that seems to impress everybody. Whether you're, what makes any sense what you're saying is not so important as that you're organized. So you're very syllabus, and boy, you're right on target. So at the in the first class in the fall of my second year of teaching, I gave the final exam that I had just given in May. And the students who had not had me, who had never studied journalism, had not had a single of the 220 hours of lectures I had prepared, did better than the ones that had it. And I started changing my teaching style. And everybody said, gee, you're a good teacher. We're glad you hired. I came in at 39 to teach. And people, boy, it's amazing that you're such a good teacher. And I said, I'm glad I have the reputation. But I knew from my own little researches that I wasn't such a great teacher. And I went more and more to conferences, more to individual instruction, more to sharing workshops and papers in class and that sort of thing. It's a lot of fun. I think there's a connection that I just see now. That as a writer, I'm constantly learning. I mean, if you're a writer, you're constantly looking at what you've written to see what you could do better. And so I just adapted that. That was in place, and I adapted that to teaching, and I didn't realize that to this moment. It was useful for me to, I revised all the time, so why not revise my teaching?
What do you do if a student can't get started?
I don't really have that problem because the way we write in the beginning, in most big courses, let's say a regular freshman English course or a course where people don't sign up to be writers, the first day usually starts by giving out 3x5 cards. And I say, write about an experience, a person, or something that's important to you. And I'm going to write two, and we'll write right now. And 3x5 cards, not intimidating, it's small. And I write, and then I share what I've written, and then we go around the class, and everybody shares. If somebody doesn't share, it's fine. If it's too personal or something, I don't announce that, but if somebody says, I don't want to share, fine, we go to the next person. I've hardly ever had anybody not write under those circumstances. We immediately get writing. I make writing a game. It's not going to be graded. We'll be grades later. They have a syllabus that explains this, that they're going to be graded at the end. We have fun writing. Most classes, we would begin by having a moment of quiet, which is very important to those of us in education, the teacher certainly included. We write for 10 minutes. Sometimes I'd share my writing, sometimes they'd share them with each other, sometimes they'd share, most of the time they wouldn't. But the expectation would be that you're right. The frightening thing about teaching is this, what is the Pygmalion complex, or there's a book, The Pygmalion's in the title, that was done out in California years ago. They took a lot of Spanish-speaking students in a school in California that were remedial students, that tested very low. They told the teachers that these students were selected for them because they had tested high. And I get goose pimples thinking about this because my own education was so mixed up and so bad. Those students did well. Their teachers expected them to do well, and they did well. And this is the thing. I expect my students to write better at the end of the course than before. I expect them to write. I'm going to write. It's going to be fun. I share with enthusiasm things I've read, and I share and respond with enthusiasm the things they write. And so most of them. The 90 and 9, I was brought up with this. I'd always like to get that other sheep, and you can't always do it. But it's a question of expectation. Lee Indusano, who teaches at BU, taught me a very important thing when I first came to teaching. She said, the student will see themselves as they are reflected in your eyes. If you want to have illiterate students, you can have them. Many of my students have worked their way through the university in part by being professional writers. But I've had professors come and say, this person's illiterate. And I say, gee, that person is editing all these papers in science for somebody over there on a project. And they're extremely literate, or they're working for a newspaper or something. And then I look at their papers, and the papers are illiterate. That teacher expects them to be illiterate. I worked a lot with athletes, and the expectation is if you have no neck, you can't write. and therefore, some of the expectations are fulfilled. So you really have to have the expectation, and it's hard. You can't just impose that. It has to be learned by experience. And the first years, it was hard for me, and I began to be more confident. And the more confident I was that everybody write, more of them wrote and wrote easily. Sounds so simple when you talk about it here, but it's really an attitude thing. And it wouldn't worry me if somebody didn't write that particular day in the very beginning, but I'm pretty compulsive about deadlines, and they would get the message. We had one student, I taught 1 8 o'clock class, and the student did show up a couple of times, and so I suggested that the class would meet in her room in the dorm, and somehow she appeared at 8 o'clock after that. So there was a certain discipline going on there.
Yes. This is kind of related to what you've been talking about when you started. How do you get some students to want to look for that sense of surprise, for that sense of adventure in their writing? I have had this semester and last semester one class where perhaps half the students will get into the spirit of play in the class, but the others sit there like rocks.
Yeah.
I think
it's very hard, first of all, as a teacher. Many students come from homes in which there isn't much language play, even more important, where there's no listening. I was surprised when our children were young and we would pick up people to drive them to play and stuff, and it was very clear that some of my children's friends had never had an adult listen to them, and they didn't know how to talk to an adult. They didn't know how to listen. They never were listened to. I think you have to listen to these people, and you have to realize that for many people coming from many environments, it can be very difficult. Some of the Native American groups and some of the Asian groups, I taught out in Hawaii for a week in a school, it is against the culture to speak up. You would never have some of those students raising their hand and volunteering. That would be actually against everything in the culture. And interestingly enough, a friend of mine has a brilliant adopted child who was taken away from Korea when he was 3 months old, has never lived in an Oriental or Asian community, and has that same kind of attitude. So you have to realize why the student is doing it. I don't think half the class has the same reason. And I would try to get to find out why in conference and talking, and talk about it in class. Some of you seem worried about the surprise. You may have found out that every time they've come up with anything of at home, if they, well, first of all, a lot of families today never eat around the table. I mean, we ate dinner around the table at Jim's house last night. That's an unusual experience for most New Hampshire students now. They've never eaten around the table, maybe Thanksgiving or Christmas. They come and go and pick up the food. And if you haven't had the experience of conversation, people listening, saying something silly and people laughing, if you have the kind of parent that as soon as you say something silly, be serious, it's very hard for those students to encourage surprise. West Point, where one of my textbooks is used, I was there last October, and they have a really interesting program. Part of their freshman English is to encourage diversity and difference. The people who choose to go to West Point tend to come from small towns, from very strict religious backgrounds. And they're conformists. They want to be